We have a question from Amanda. Really good question. She says, how can I discern why my child cannot make eye contact when I'm trying to get him to listen? So he was diagnosed, he has a few things going on, diagnosed with mild autism, severe ADHD combined type, and auditory processing disorder. So I think maybe wondering, like, is it the social component? Is it the attention component that's making it difficult to make eye contact?
Jill, do you want me to jump in first, or would you like to jump in?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, and again, you know, my forte is not in autism or Asperger's or you know, any of ASD, but the eye contact can tend to be a different part of the brain, and it can tend to be more a function of some of the Asperger's mild autism than the inattention. Though sometimes there's a little bit of both, right? And so, but yeah, so that may be it. Now that would be a whole nother rabbit trail that we can go down, but that would be the short answer, is it could be a little bit of both, but it definitely will be more likely on the mild autism side. But even that, even the mild autism, if we look at the brain like a mansion with many rooms and hallways, then we can maybe not necessarily throw away, but we can have this kind of binocular vision, be able to see two things at the same time, or be able to flicker between the two. Not just I have autism, I have Asperger's, I have ADHD, but rather which rooms are overfiring or underfiring, right? Which rooms are connecting more or not connected enough? And so the problem, and I say that because oftentimes, if there's a certain room that is overfiring, well, it may make me a little bit quirky. It may make me a little bit, you know, less socially active. But if it overfires up to a certain level, beyond a certain level, now all of a sudden that can be now categorized as some type of Asperger's, right? Mm-hmm. And so an Asperger's may involve 5 or 6 or 20 rooms. And so, but again, the label disempowers me. I hate to say it, but I'm as a parent, fine, it may give me a little bit of comfort to know that at least there's a name for this thing, but it doesn't give me any empowerment to do anything about it. But if I can understand that my child in my brain is not just one glob of jelly, it's actually this mansion with many rooms, specialized rooms and hallways that connect them. And in order for me to do everything I need to do, requires each one of these rooms to be able to be not too high, not too little. They ideally, they're little Goldilocks. And so what if I can understand my child's brain from that perspective, now I can start looking for tools that are going to be able to maybe make this area a little bit higher, this area a little bit lower, help regulate these things. So I'm now more empowered. I can now start looking for real practical tools. And that's what Stoll Learning Center is about, is breaking that down into those core functions. And let's find tools to help those different things. So for me as a parent, I want to be empowered. I don't want to just be lulled back to think, well, at least that's what he's got, so someone else will take care of him. I'm the type of parent that I want to now go find tools for my child. And that second model is going to help me do that better, I believe. So.
Right. And, you know, when you talk about labels, I think the value of a label for me as a practitioner is that it helps me to understand a child's thinking style a little bit better so that I can identify those rooms that are over or under firing. But I agree. I mean, you are not your ADHD, or you are not your autism, or whatever it is. Now, in relation to this question, it's interesting because there are different reasons why someone might have difficulty with eye contact. It could be, and this does happen sometimes with our kids that are on the autism spectrum, sometimes their eyes are taking in too much light. And so it's a little bit painful for them to look at someone else's eyes. It's so that could be part of it. And again, that is something that can be trained. The eyes can be trained to, and the brain can be trained to take in light properly. And then the other thing is with auditory processing, sometimes students have to work so hard to get the information auditorily that they kind of have to shut off the other sense and they can't be looking and listening at the same time. So, you know, that is, that's a really good question. And there's not a simple answer, but it is something that we certainly, you know, have explored with students. And then when we can identify where it's coming from, then we can really work to make that aspect work more effectively.
Yeah.
Awesome. I know there's so many factors, so it's really good to hear that all broken down. We've got another question. We have a couple questions kind of about steps to take when seeking a doctor, but I'll start here. So Susan is asking, what's the best way and what kind of doctor do I see to test for ADD or ADHD? And once the testing is done, what are some of the treatments besides drugs? Any thoughts on that?
So the treatment part, we are going to be talking about. We definitely want to devote some time to that. But go ahead, Dr. Licata.
Well, again, so what we need to know is that the majority of, again, if we're looking for the diagnosis of ADD or ADHD, and there's an incentive structure behind getting our kids diagnosed, we'll get, many times governments will pay for extra classes or there's certain benefits to getting the diagnosis, and that's a little bit of another conversation. But in short, it's usually pediatricians that end up doing the diagnosis. It's usually pediatricians. It seems like the majority of our colleagues it's the pediatricians that do it, and then they're the ones that diagnose it. Now, psychiatrists also tend to diagnose and prescribe. And so those tend to be the two avenues through which people end up getting that diagnosis. Now, what we have to understand, though, is that we can't hold our doctors accountable. Well, we can't hold them guilty for then prescribing a medication when, in essence, that's what their license allows them to do, is prescribe a medication. And I think that that's what they're great at. And so I'm trying to kind of tiptoe around this because, in essence, where we're going to go get the diagnosis is usually the next step is going to be to get a medication. And if we are okay with that and we understand that that's the lens that the doctor is going to be wearing when you go get tested, then that's then we can understand that. Okay, well, that's my doctor's lens. I'm going to now understand that I'm not going to hold them. I'm not going to be surprised when they don't recommend some other things. Okay.
Right.
And so, now, I'm not going to say to do one thing or the other, but I just want you to be empowered with that. Now, there are others that can do things that will help look at the breakdown of the brain and see, well, what's overfunctioning and underfunctioning. And again, Stoll Learning Centers is a wonderful place to do that. We do brain mapping. We can also see what the brain's doing. There's a whole group of specialists called neuropsychologists. They can also do like 1 to 2 day full testing. I mean, they test everything under the sun to see how is your child functioning and what are the different rooms doing in the hallways and how is that playing out in this person, in my child's personality and their emotions and their ability to, you know, do things at school. So I guess, you know, this is kind of a roundabout way to say there's the conventional and then there are these others. And as long as we have good expectations about what they're going to give us, then we won't be disappointed. Okay. So I don't know. That's going to be my best answer for that one.
and so, you know, as a parent, if you really need to have that diagnosis in order for your child to get an IEP at school or get a 504 plan or some kind of support, then you're probably going to go to your pediatrician. And to get that. But, you know, there are people that more do a more natural approach to treatment with supplements and diet. Sometimes that is chiropractors. Sometimes that's a naturopath. You know, at Stoa Learning Centers, we really look to try to evaluate, you know, what are the underlying skills that are not supporting the student well enough and therefore stressing the attention system, because then we can develop those underlying skills and the attention symptoms usually go away. Or if attention is the key issue, then what we know from our experience is it usually is going to be a combination of training, which we do, and diet, and you know, some kind of biological aspect, usually diet and maybe some supplements that are going to be a good combination. Dr. Licata, and so then there is, you know, the kind of work that Dr. Licata does, which is really, really amazing, because they are looking at what parts of the brain are overfiring or underfiring, and actually have a pretty, based on our students' input, a pretty fun way to treat that and effective. So let's go ahead and talk about that, and then we'll come back and pick up the other questions.
Yeah. So so we love science, and so we like Stoll Learning Centers want to create science-based tools to both measure and improve our function. I mean, that's really what this is about. And so what we do to measure the brain is we have, you know, a child will come into the office and they will wear a cap. It's like a swimming cap with 19 different sensors. And we'll look at the brain waves. We'll literally see their brain waves, right? And this is called an EEG. And so right away, here's the difference between check a bunch of boxes off of a list. Oh, you've got ADHD or you don't. What about if we actually saw this, the actual brainwaves of the child and measured those things, right? And so what we want to do is measure what the brain is doing, measure the different regions, and then we compare that child's brain to other boys or girls that child's age. And we don't want them to be just like everyone else, but we want to be able to see, well, does this child have access to a lot of the same things that other kids do? And so we can then begin to create a little bit of a fingerprint. We can create a little bit of a phenotype on, when we see brain waves that are too high or low in this one room, it tends to look like a certain flavor of inattention. It tends to do that. And if the child is coming in with inattention, well, wait a second, that fits. Right. And so that's a way for us to measure. And that's what we call that brain mapping, measuring the brain waves of the brain. And then we train by literally putting a little stethoscope. And I say it's not really stethoscope, but it's just, we're not doing anything to the brain. We're just sensing the brain on that room. And then the child essentially plays video games with their mind. For if they're doing it at home, it's about 15 minutes a day. If it's in the office, they're doing it for about 45 minutes, about once or about two or three times a week. And so what we do is we get to train that region that was too high. We get to train it to slowly begin to lower itself so that it can access lower, slower brain waves. That's it. We're not making it do one thing or the other. We just help it get unstuck. And then if it needs to go high, it can, but it doesn't have to stay there, it can go back down. And so in about 12 to 16 weeks, we see about a 50% improvement in the functions that are like attention or impulse control or any of those others, rather than have a child dependent on certain things for the rest of their life. So that's in essence, that's what we do.
And I like talking about it getting unstuck, because it's so, you know, we get into patterns and we sometimes have to have some help to break that pattern so that we can create a more effective one. And I will just tell you a little bit about, we recently collaborated with a student to do this neurofeedback brain training. And he was one of those kids whose brain was working so hard to pay attention, is what the brain map showed. But it really cost him in anxiety, which came across as withdrawal and lack of motivation. And then that was all compounded with remote schooling. Oh, yeah. But after completing the neurofeedback, we really saw very encouraging improvement in engagement and mood and focus. And then at the same time at the Learning Center, we were working with this student to develop the underlying skills that he needed to listen and read and think faster. And, you know, I really am excited for him to start school this year, because even though it's remote, I think it's going to go great for him. And, you know, that's awesome. That's why we do this work. Yeah. So,
yes. And what it is it's really about, we can see and measure potential. That's really what we're doing. Potential is no longer this kind of pie in the sky thing. Oh, you can be anything you want to be. You're 5'2" and you can be a professional NBA player. Maybe, but you may not have as much potential as someone other. But we can see potential. And we can see that you have everything you need. It's just there's certain patterns that are stuck. And those patterns, we can help them get unstuck. You can access things that you couldn't, that you feel more, the child feels more like you, like themselves. They feel like the fuller version of themselves. And to be able to do that in a way that's science-based, then it would be able to a way that's more rigorous than what is done conventionally, right? Mm-hmm. Before and after, you know, measuring so many different types of, you know, auditory processing, visual processing, attention, you know, and measuring them over time, doing neurocognitive tests. I mean, it's more rigorous than checking out a bunch of boxes and then saying, well, good luck. Let's see how this goes. That's, you know, it's profound. And what Stoll Learning Centers allows kids to do, it's what we like to do too, is we love to help measure and then help your child access their potential, right, in a less fluffy way. Right. So yes, it's huge. It's huge.
I love that. Yeah. I love that. We do have quite a few questions, kind of going along with the skill-based stuff. We have a few questions along those lines. So Amy is wondering, what is your strategy for improving working memory for a child where their verbal comprehension and perceptual reasoning are very superior, but working memory is just average? I don't know who wants to tackle that, but that's the question.
Verbal comprehension. And tell me again, verbal comprehension and?
So verbal comprehension and reasoning are great, but working memory is more of the struggle.
You know, I feel like I don't exactly have enough information to have a really good picture of exactly what we would do. But what we do in our assessment is we are looking at all of those factors. So long-term memory, working memory, attention, auditory processing, visual processing, reasoning, certainly verbal comprehension, and you know, the academic pieces as well. But what I would want to look at is there something going on in the auditory or visual processing that is causing them to maybe not get accurate information to think with? It could be a memory issue, you know, that they're not taking in enough information at one time. And so we have a number of different ways that we attack that. But we do processing skills training, which is heavily based in developing working memory and processing speed, which, if you wanted to know what it looks like, it looks like all different kinds of games and drills, and all the activities they're very different, but they're based in being able to build your working memory and your processing speed along with other critical underlying skills. Mm-hmm. And it's intensive, but it's pretty fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what Jill's also alluding to is that there are multiple types of working memory, right? And sometimes there's working memory and what we think is working memory, which is more short-term memory. And oftentimes they're superimposed. So there's a little bit of entanglement. So it's rooms and hallways, but there's entanglement in some of them. And so, again, sometimes it's a little bit more testing that I'm sure the Stoll Learning Centers do and we do. because it depends on that child. So for instance, there's what we call standard working memory, and there's verbal memory, and then there's visual spatial memory. And usually whenever you have one, it's coming along with some other things. So there again, however you got tested, I think it's phenomenal that you're already asking that quality of question, because you're starting to think using a different operating system. You're starting to think like, what are the right ingredients that I want to give my child so they can make all the dishes that they can make, rather than just, you know, how come my kid can't make good spaghetti, right? Like, so what ingredients does my child have? And that's an important question. So, but working memory, it really depends on what type of working memory. Is it really that they don't have great working memory, or is it more of a short-term memory? Is it verbal, visual, spatial, or is it a combination? That's where it gets harder on online to answer that simple question, but yeah.
All right, perfect. I know it's definitely complex. When I first read the question, I was like, is she a parent of ours? Like, she knows so many terms.
That's
like,
a great question. It's a great question. That is the type of questions we want to start asking. Now, that's a lot for a lot of us parents. I mean, it's easy for us to talk about this because we spend all of our day, every day talking about this. But a parent who has a different profession, this is a whole new language. It's a whole new vocabulary. And so that's okay. You don't need to know all of it, but do you have somebody who is at least thinking that way that you can trust, right? Stoll Learning Centers is one of them. Vital, you know, Head and Spine is one of them. You may have others in your area, but, you know, we have people that fly in to see us. There's people that work remotely with Stoll. You just know that that's, at least if you're starting to feel like, wait a second, I got to start thinking about this. I want to find professionals that are thinking this way. That's the beginning.
Yeah. Definitely.
Awesome. Along the lines of other professionals, we have a couple recommendation questions. And if you don't know off the top of your head, you can always let us know later. We can post them in the notes. But Susan's wondering if there are any recommendations for neurophysiologists. I don't know where she lives, but...
Yeah. So in essence, I don't... Joe, I'll let you go... this is my thought. Do you mean a neuropsychologist? And if you mean a neuropsychologist, you know, we recommend people here in Pasadena, but California, but there are many others. But remember, I tend not to give great straight answers. I tend to try to help you with the context. The context is, I need someone who's going to start, who can test using this new way of thinking, who tests for my child's ingredients. And then I also may need others that can actually do the treatment or therapy or training for those things. And sometimes one person is great for testing, but they have nothing to offer you as far as the actual training. Some places are both. Stoll Learning Centers is both. You know, we're both. But also my practice, we tend to be great with four things: sleep, attention, concussions, and anxiety-like tendencies. That's it. So we don't try to do everything, and we're not good at everything. And so we're great at those things. And when someone comes to us with more complex issues, we usually then say, well, maybe you need a team around you. Maybe we'll take care of this one part. Now that we have the right testing, you need certain ingredients. You know, we'll do these parts, and maybe let's recommend someone, two or three others, to do the others. So that's where, again, if you the thinking about who's the tester, who's the trainer, and some can do both, but can they do both for everything that my child needs? That's what we want to start to. That's how we want to start to think in a more empowered way, I think. So
perfect. And then she did respond, yes, neuropsychology. So
okay, great. Yeah. Yes. I don't. And they're Jill, maybe you do in general, but.
You know, like you, we connect with professionals in our area, and when we find like-minded professionals, we definitely refer to them. Out of the area, not so much, I'm so sorry to say, but
yeah.
But I think that's really helpful what you're saying about how to think about it. So
Great, great. And we do have another therapy question. What kind of therapy do you recommend for to help my 7-year-old with big emotions and executive function skills?
Jill, do you want to go? I can go after you.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I think this may be a slight segue into the brain training in general. Across the country, there are probably about 500 or so people who do something called neurofeedback. And the challenge is that probably 90% don't start with a map. And so ideally, we'd like to have a child get a map. They wear it, they could see the brain waves, we know exactly what's going on. Then out of that, so it's a smaller group of the neurofeedback world. And then of that group, there are different people that have different qualities. It's a little bit of a Wild West, but they have different qualifications to be able to help a child train up or down some of these rooms or hallways. And so you may want to look around your area and see if someone is doing that. Someone is able to get a brain map. Someone does brain mapping. Someone does neurofeedback. And there's different subcategories of neurofeedback. But, our practice, we only take on 4 types of clients. We tend to be very, very good at those 4. And we always keep focusing on getting better. But it's a resource. It's a tool. And so, we'll have people that will fly down, get the brain map, and then they fly home. And then we give them everything they need, and they just wear a little band around their head with a little sensor they can put on with a little bit of gel, and their child can play video games for 15 minutes a day. And it can train up or down some of these things. But big emotions is oftentimes a dysregulation of feeling. And there could be multiple rooms that are involved with that. And so it's a little bit of a slippery answer, but with the right map, we can tell you a lot more, right? And so we're good at doing the testing and doing the training, but the big emotion part is sometimes a little bit outside of our wheelhouse. But there may be others in your area who's asking the question that may be just right for you. So you may want to look them up.
Awesome. And I'll tell you, again, of course, we don't really have enough information to give you exact, information about your child. But thinking about a 7-year-old who, has kind of overwhelming emotions and you're thinking executive function, well, I think, one of the things could be that child is operating in fight or flight. And when we are, and sometimes that goes back to retained primitive reflexes, which we're going to do a show on one of these days because it's a big subject. Yeah. But if your child is kind of just operating in fight or flight, they're not going to have good executive function because the rational brain isn't even available while they're, kind of in that hyper alert state. And it's going to be very easy for them to be oversensitive, to fly off the handle. And so these are definitely things that we deal with our students. But let me just give you 2 things that you can just try to start doing. Yeah, a lot of things come to mind, but here's one thing. When your child is in a pretty, not in a hyper alert state, but just, kind of a nice time that you're together, teach them how to do five count breathing. Young kids, sometimes we do 3 count, but just breathe in for, let's say, 3 counts. Breathe in. Out. So breathe in through the nose, out through the mouth. If they can go up to 4 or 5 counts, great. Don't hold the breath, just in, 5, out, 5. In through the nose, out through the mouth. Do that. Just practice that. practice it at different times of day when your child is doing fine. And that becomes a tool that he can use before things that tend to upset him, if it's reading or schoolwork or having to do chores, or, you know, you start with your five count breath, do three of them in a row, starts to settle the system down. Another thought is what's called cross crawls. You could Google this and you'll probably see it on YouTube, a demonstration of cross crawls. It's through Brain Gym. And have your child cross elbow to the opposite knee, back and forth like this. And you do it with them to keep them from going too fast. And they just breathe slowly, do it for about a minute, and it will start to settle them down. And so if you know the triggers for him, do those things first. Use them as a brain break in school. You know, just that is just settling the system a little bit, and then he's going to be able to think more rationally. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of thoughts.
That's wonderful. Maddie,
let's go back to you so we can kind of wrap up.
Yeah. So this is, I know you talked a lot about professionals, so the answer might be the same. I'll take it down in a second. but Heather expresses that her son has actually Tourette's syndrome and they're homeschooling. They've tried for 7 years to help him with his retention and attention skills. He struggles in math and in general, just retention. But he loves music. And so he tends to have better attention when it's something that he likes. So she's kind of just asking for maybe some other tips when they go to see the doctor. I don't know if it applies the same other stuff you said, but if there's anything additional for her situation, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the short answer for her may be to find a neurofeedback specialist who has experience working with Tourette's. Tourette's will be a constant interrupter to his brain, right? To his brain. It's 100 times a second. And oftentimes, you know, it's when it's finally loud enough that it comes out, but the brain in small ways is just doing this overfiring. And so it's going to be near impossible to hold a certain train of thought or any constant attention, because of that. And so it may not be a solution for Tourette's, but it may turn that down enough to the point where it's now, you know, functional. And again, I think like we don't work with it, but it's something that I do know there are specialists that work with in the neurofeedback world. Try it. Outside of that, I don't know.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. We do have a question. I'm not super familiar with this, but maybe you guys are. Can people be HSP type, good use using sensory and problem solving, 3D spatial use, et cetera, and be with ADHD that needs treating? Any thoughts on that one?
I don't know. I think what you're asking, I'll answer this. The brain reserves the right to have more than one room not working as great as we want, right? And all the combination of rooms and hallways that are not as great as we'd like become the source of every diagnosis we give, really. So, yeah, you can have a lot of things not right. And that's where I think Jill has been alluding to often. If you have someone who's looking at the different ways and can, you know, start training them individually or collectively together, then the training becomes customized to the child. Because, yeah, you could totally have that. You can have multiple things all at once. In fact, anybody who's worked with children know there's usually more than one thing always happening at once, right? Yeah. Again, I think Jill's been ahead of her time, breaking down not just what, you know, what, again, if it's a metaphor of food, you know, gosh, you know, my kid has spaghetti problems. They have spaghetti problems. Well, if Jill breaks it down and says, well, what are the ingredients that you're working with right here? Let's see if we can fix the ingredients. The plate of spaghetti may be better, right? Or, oh, my child has whatever, you know, pork chop problems. Like let's bring it down to the core ingredients. And so yes, you could totally have multiple things. I'm sure they do. So then the question is no, and then find the right tools to fit that child's needs.
And, you know, in our experience, the encouraging thing is that as you start to work in one or two of those areas, it's kind of like other areas begin to come in line as well. So that's an encouraging thing.
Oh, yeah.
We have amazing brains.
It's true. We do have a question about assessments. I don't know if she's talking about functional assessments like we do or more of a clinical type of assessment, but Ronke is wondering how much of these assessments can be done virtually.
Jill, I'll leave that to you.
We do, you know, there are certainly some things that we do that the testing world hasn't found a way to do remotely yet. But we do remote screenings now and really have since March and have found it to be very, very effective. And I think that's partly because what we're doing is a functional assessment. We really want to see, you know, how things are working in real life. So a lot can be done remotely. We have been really, really pleased with that.
Yes, I can definitely attest to that. We've started so many students, at least at the Irvine branch, with purely remote. Yeah, we did their full screening and they're like finishing up their stuff right now, which is really cool to see. We had a question about I think it's a particular assessment. I'm not familiar. What about the WISC IV test? Are you familiar with that one?
The WISC, yeah. I do not give that test. That is given by a psychologist, school psychologist or a clinical psychologist. And I don't know if that can be given remotely yet or not.
Okay, perfect. Sorry, that was out of order. I should have given some context that she wasn't asking about remote, just any opinions on it, I guess. And it's effective, or I don't know, any opinions on the test in general.
Well, remember, if I can comment on it, there are, at least we're talking, so tests become functional assessments, and functional is, how are they able to access certain, again, rooms and hallways? There are many rooms and hallways, so there must be many functional tests. And there will be no one single test that measures every single room and hallway. The best attempt at it is a 1 to 2 day full battery where you're literally in the office for 1 to 2 days straight taking tests. And that is what a neuropsychological test is trying to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and oftentimes the cost for that is, you know, much more, sometimes 3, 4, 5 times the price of the training for the individual things that you want to do, right? So there are many tests. There are many tests. Now, again, for a parent who wants to navigate the world of tests, just understand, well, are they testing a certain levels of what we call intelligence? Are they looking at some of these core resources? I like Stoll's, you know, philosophy. And if you read Jill Stoll's book, you know, if you can understand that, and that becomes your kind of hitchhiker's guide to my child's brain, it'll help you kind of navigate and ask some better questions about which tests are good for what, right? I'm aware of the intelligence scale for kids. I think it's the Whiskler. I'm looking it up now because mm-hmm. I couldn't remember his name, the Wechsler intelligence right. scale. But there are many intelligence scales, and those intelligence scales are pretty much just broken down into smaller ingredients, smaller core resources. We use another company that's called Cambridge Brain Sciences, and they you can do online, and it's 12 core functions of, you know, mental processing. And that's really helpful too. There are many. That's going to be the challenge. Is this one good or is that one good? Is this one better or is that one better? Well, what are you trying to accomplish? Is a hammer better than a screwdriver? Well, what are you trying to do? Right. What, and so that's my another attempt to not give you a straight answer.
But I will tell you the one thing, kind of like we said earlier, where you don't want ADHD. Okay, I've got it. I'm stuck with it. You know, that's me. Well, with an intelligence test like the WISC, just know that you've got to really interpret it, you know? And if all you do is you look at the composite score, it gives you some information, but that's not a true picture until you really look at all the different subtests. And most of the time, what happens is parents end up with a score that categorizes their child somewhere. And as a practitioner, if someone comes to me with a WISC, I'm going to be looking at all those different subtests to see, you know, where the child's strengths and weaknesses are and how they clump together and things like that. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do the neurocognitive test. We also do the IVA too, which is like a TOVA, which is just a big fancy way of saying we're measuring attention and impulse control. And it breaks those down into visual and auditory processing. And yes, we really want to know what the individual aspects of that child's score are, because that's what we want to train. And then we train those up, and then the scores go up. In fact, we expect the scores to go up. We believe on our part, we failed if we didn't help the scores go up. And so, but we need to have that interpretation, and that interpretation is really, really important. So yeah, I agree.
Great. I realize that it's WISC. The IV is for four Roman numerals. Okay. So that great, Maddie.